first thing, I just kind of highlighted in blue this portion. And the question that I sent out regarding the curses and everything, I don't have it right for me, but I believe the wording was basically, hey, what were the curses that God put on them? Are those curses still in effect today? When I was talking, I kind of jumped straight to the spiritual application of those things. So the question came back, so, well, there were physical curses and everything there. And that's exactly right. On the serpent, man, and woman, you have those physical curses, and those curses are still in effect today. But my focus, and maybe it's just a badly worded question, the focus I was trying to go to was the spiritual application of that. And when you have that issue, their situation in the garden and the result of their sin, the separation from God, and everything that they were that you had to endure there, you have that curse of sin. And that curse has been lifted in Christ. Christ has reunited us, has reconciled us to God. He has washed, given us the means to take away our sins through his blood and our obedience to him. So in me just jumping straight to the end of the thought, if that confused anybody, I apologize for that. Also, too, question was raised as far as in Genesis 4, at the tail end of that, we talk about at this time that men began to call upon the name of the Lord. In some translations, some versions of the Bible, instead of saying calling on the name of the Lord, it says that this is where men begin to worship the Lord. And it's like, okay, is that what it means? And is that kind of how does that relate to the points I was bringing up with Peter and so on from there? I don't have a problem with the translation and saying that worship, but when you look at the language, from what I can tell, the literal is exactly how it reads in King James and New King James and most versions that we use, where it says calling upon the name of the Lord. So if you're looking at, if it says worship, I don't think that's a problem, but I don't think it's so much the act of worship as it is why they were worshiping God. And I think it's along the lines of they're recognizing their inadequacies, they're recognizing who God was, how great he is, and because of their inadequacies and his greatness, the need they have for him. So when you look from that perspective, and then the example that I was using with Peter, and while he had this physical standpoint of walking on the water with Christ, the spiritual application there, as soon as he started sinking in the sea, he looked up and saw that, he recognized he was helpless, hopeless, and Jesus was his only means of salvation. And when we're looking at that from a spiritual standpoint, we're drowning in a sea of sin. And as soon as we realize that and we recognize that Jesus is our only hope of salvation, we call out to him for salvation. So it is recognized. So I think those are related points. If you go back to what was talked about in Genesis 4, and that application to Peter, is we're recognizing who Jesus is and our inadequacies and our need for him. And there, but it doesn't stop there. You know, in the religious world today, that's where a lot of people will stop. And just say, hey, you just call on Jesus. You ask him to be your personal savior. You say a prayer and ask him to enter your heart or some words to that effect. And everything's fine from there. No. Well, that's not what the Bible teaches. And that's where I was bringing Saul of Tarsus in, because in Saul of Tarsus, I think we have an excellent example of what the complete story, if you will, of calling on the name of the Lord is about. Because, and if you go back when he's on the road to Damascus and he realizes and comes to the very clear realization, hey, I thought I was working with God. I thought I was helping him. Man, was I wrong. I've been fighting against God. And Jesus Christ is indeed his prophet. And not only that, is indeed Lord and is God. And when he came to that realization, he asked Jesus, "What, Lord, what would you have me to do?" Well, Jesus didn't tell him, "We're good." He didn't tell him, okay, I've entered your heart or anything like that. He told him, you go to the city and it'll be told you what you must do. And 3 days later, Ananias came to him. And after speaking to him for a while, the culmination is what we have in Acts 22. When he told him, why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. So calling on the name of the Lord is not just this mental situation where we affirm and believe in God and we're asking him for help. That's the beginning. But it is trusting, not only recognizing him, but trusting him, submitting to him, and obeying him, just as Saul of Tarsus did. Everything. So again, I kind of jumped to the end on a little bit of that, especially that was our last slide last week. So if I left a point or two hanging there, I'm sorry about that, but hopefully that might clear up any confusion that I might have caused. Okay, so with that, we'll go ahead and get into today's lesson. In Acts 10 and 11, you know, this is a challenge in some ways because I'm sure we would all just love to go into the chapter and a half of genealogies that we have here and just study those in great depth. But we're not going to do that. But we are going to touch on that, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But this first slide, just trying to lay out, okay, what do we see in these two chapters? And the thing is, chapter 10 is kind of a big picture view. It's giving us a big picture view of how the world was populated after the flood through Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And through this chapter, it starts highlighting some key individuals in these lineages of these three sons, and also gives us the origins of some key nations that that become relevant to in the Old Testament relative to Israel in the Old Testament. So it's, again, a big picture view. Chapter 11 is kind of a subset of what's happening in chapter 10, everything. Chapter 10 gives us the big picture. Now chapter 11 comes back and provides some more detailed account of some key things. The Tower of Babel, the lineage from Shem to Abram, and then introduces us to Abram, okay? So these aren't separate chapters. We're 10 and then we're gonna get into 11. 11 is part of 10. It's a subset of it. And so with that, start getting into a little bit of the questions here. And just, like I said, I don't want to go in depth into every verse of the genealogy, but let's just talk about the genealogies that we have here. You know, how were Shem, Ham, and Japheth's descendants separated into their lands according to chapter 10, verses 5, 20, and 31?
According to their genealogies and clans and languages and lands and nations.
Yeah, the key thing, thank you, Larry. Key thing there, depending on the version you have, at least in mind, the two things that it keys on in each of those is according to their language and according to their families, or tribes, nations, what you may have there. But this is how God separated it. Okay, and we can probably already see, without, I don't want to jump ahead to chapter 11, but we can already see the effects of the Tower of Babel in that. One of the key distinguishing factors, the key things that he did here in separating the people and spreading them over the earth was via their language as well as their families. Okay. Now, this is just a thought question. I don't have it. There's not a perfect answer to this next question, but I just want to kind of entertain your thoughts a little bit on it. Why do you think God would preserve this account? And some people call it the Table of Nations, but why would he preserve this account for us? Any particular reasons you can think of? Go ahead, Jim.
I think it's just for us to trust and increase our faith in the fact that right after the events of Noah and his family, that they did operate here, as you said, that that's what happened. And this is, partly, even though it's, it's for our spiritual book, it is a historical record. So we get that, and we can have confidence in that, that Noah's own sons, they continue to operate in this.
Okay. For those on Zoom, what Joe was just mentioning is it has both a physical and a spiritual thing for us there. One, it's a historical account of what happened and how the earth was populated, how Shem, Ham, and Japheth went forth from there, and the earth ended up being populated, but also is a spiritual reference there and increasing our faith and helping to fortify our faith in seeing how these things happened. And in this case, taking us all the way down to Abram, who of course becomes Abraham, a very key figure in the Bible. Yes, great.
One thing I was thinking too is it really shows the commonality among all people, ultimately, invading from God. And we're about to get into the promises that God made to Abraham, which were really to all nations. And so I think it kind of sets up that God really desires a relationship with all people, even though the bulk of the Old Testament is now going to turn eventually to one particular nation. His intent all along was with all people.
Again, for those on Zoom, Greg makes some good points here, is that in seeing this and we see the origins of these things, we see the commonality that we have amongst each other and should help us to see and better understand the relationship that God desires with his creation. Even though, as we go into further into the Old Testament, we're going to get focused on the nation of Israel. But because when we get into the promises made to Abraham here this Wednesday, those promises, especially the third, is for all nations. So hopefully this helps us to keep that in focus. Gene, I think you were about to say something as well.
Well, I don't know how accurate it is, but I've always just looked at the bloodlines as a way to possibly trace the bloodline of Christ. Again, I'm not sure how accurate that is because really Abraham comes in Genesis 12, but I've just always looked at the genealogies as a way of tracing the bloodline of Christ.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. We certainly see that. That's when you look in Matthew and Luke and they're tracing the genealogy that goes back to them. And that gets, y'all hit on the, I had two main things and we talked about that. I think one of the main things here in preserving it for us is we see here in the beginning it's providing us that ability to trace the genealogies back to Christ, as well as all the other great points that y'all made in there. And when you look at the nations, just to give you an idea of where they ended up spreading out, you can see, if you kind of using Babylon, kind of right. I wish I had a long pointer or laser pointer, cause that's, where the Tower of Babel was. So they dispersed from there. Going west from there, you have Ham and his descendants from Canaan and on out, Shem kind of south, east through there. And then going north and out, Japheth. His people there. So Japheth, pretty much Asia and Europe, the Gentiles, as it talks about in verse 5, from talking about Japheth, from these, the coastlands of the nations were separated into, different version had the coastlands of the Gentiles. So that's what I get for reading two or three different versions during the week. they overlap. But the Gentiles basically came from Japheth and then Ham and Shem down these areas. And there is a, this is, I would term this as kind of a 100,000 foot view in general, because as we'll see, Babylon's kind of interesting there. It kind of has it there with Shem's descendants, but as we're going to see, who ends up, who actually establishes Babel and as well as Nineveh is actually a descendant of Ham. So there's a little bit of overlap in there, but just to give you a general idea of where these families, their descendants, spread. And again, just looking very quickly, when you look at Shem, it's kind of interesting here. By far, the line that we're interested in, most applicable to us, at least from a spiritual standpoint, would be going straight down the middle, down through Eber and Shub, Terah, of course, to get to Abraham, and then going down through Isaac, Jacob, because that's what's going to lead us to Christ eventually. But when you look at this, it is interesting because you can see all that, especially Abraham, we get to focusing on him and, who came from Isaac as well as Ishmael, and then his sons through his concubine over on that far your left, my right. But also too, for instance, if you go up at the top and Aram, you look at those four sons, you have one name there, Uz. Assuming this is the same Uz, do we know of anybody who is from the land of Uz? Pop quiz. Job. Yeah, I think I heard that back there. So assuming that's the same Uz, we see a look, maybe get a little insight into Job and everything there. And there are others that we could talk about there. But by far, our interest is going to be in Abraham, and that's where we're going to be talking the next four classes. Okay. Whoops. Okay. Let's see if I just skipped it twice. Okay. Ham is another very interesting, when you look at his lineage. Ham, one of his sons was Canaan, who, of course, is the Canaan of the Old Testament, that land that the Israelites ultimately inherited. But when you look here, you see a lot of nations that we become very familiar with in the Old Testament that the Israelites have to contend with. You see the Philistines, and then under Canaan, the Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites, Hivites, all the Ites that we see in the Old Testament seem like they come from Canaan and everything. But then over on the other side, you have Cush, and you go down to his, going over to one side, Ramah, under him, Sheba. Assuming the same Sheba, maybe the queen of Sheba, that land. Again, nothing big, but just kind of interesting. But then Nimrod, if you go straight down from Cush, the first name down there is Nimrod. And we're going to talk about him a little bit more, but you see from him, Babylon, Assyria, Nineveh. These are the cities and the nations that came from him and everything. So when you're talking Ham and his descendants, these are the people that the Jews, that the Israelites were having to contend with throughout most of the history of the Old Testament. There'll be others, but at least through their conquering of the land and until much later, with Medo-Persians and things like that, we see some others come in. But the immediate thing here, they're contending with the descendants of Ham for the most part. So any, just before we get into the next thing we're going to talk about is Nimrod, but any general thoughts as far as these genealogy, either Shem or Ham or anything? Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe just looking back to that prophecy, I guess, that Noah made to his sons, and that, you know, he certainly had it was a curse on Ham, and that he and his descendants would end up serving Shem, which we see the Israelites. Mm-hmm. So we see some of the initiation of the conflict even back to the time of Noah and his prophecy.
Yeah, what Greg was just bringing out was when you go back to Noah's curse, that he had on Ham at the end of chapter 9. You can kind of see how this goes here. You got Ham, and then ultimately the Israelites come in with the purpose of conquering them to take over the land of Canaan. But you can see because of all the conflict and everything that we're going to have in the Old Testament between the Israelites and Ham's descendants, you can see the relationship to that curse from Noah. Yes, Ned.
I think it's interesting too to consider the original audience for whom this was written. And God is, you know, the Holy Spirit, of course, is helping Moses to see who these people are and to share it with the Israelites as they leave Egypt. And so it's kind of a reintroduction to, we're going back to this land. Let me tell you where these people came from. They're relatives of yours, and let me tell you how they settled in the land. So it's kind of interesting to take that perspective of it, yeah, and know which nations came from which people, and they get to kind of have their eyes open about the neighbors they're about to meet.
Yeah, Debbie just made a really good point there, especially in, when you look at who the original audience was for the book of Genesis and these writings here. And you have Moses, who is providing this to the Israelites as they're coming out of Egypt and making their way towards Canaan. It's a great introduction for them, or whether introduction or re-education, whatever the right word would be there, and helping them to understand who it is they're actually going to go see and giving them the background on who these people were, how they came into existence, how they may relate to them in ways of lineage, but also going back to Noah, his curse, all these things. So it's a great backdrop there for them in a re-education and preparing them as they're approaching the land of Canaan. So good point. Okay, anything else here? All right, just a little bit here. I want to talk a little bit about Nimrod. Let's just go to chapter 10. I want to read verses 8 through 12 real quick, and then we'll talk about him. It says, now Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad in the land of Shinar. From that land, he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh and Reboth, and Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. That is the great city. One of the questions I sent out, and depending on how you see this, you may think, okay, what in the world does this mean? I recognize that up front, so we'll explain it. But I asked, you know, Nimrod is described as a mighty hunter before the Lord. What does this say about his character? Any thoughts? Is this talking about, okay, he was a mighty hunter like Esau, so he had the same faults as Esau? Or is it saying something different? Go ahead, Jeff.
When I was looking at it, I noticed that there are a few places that said that it might have been the Lord
discovered Abram. I can
barely
hear you. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. I looked at a few places that are commented that it said that maybe the Lord bestowed favor on Nimrod.
Actually, it's going to be the opposite of that. What Joe's saying in some of the references he was looking at is like God may have bestowed favor on him or something. But I think it's the opposite of that. You have to look into the words here. But and let's just go ahead and look at this. A couple of key words, and this is what I had italicized and underlined. First of all, hunter. When we think of a hunter, we think of somebody that's going out and trying to, you know, deer hunter or whatever, somebody hunting for prey. When you look, and you can pretty much glean this from the context, that that's not the kind of hunter that Nimrod was. You know, because it talks about his kingdom and everything. He is a mighty one. He is somebody who is not a hunter of food, but he's a conqueror of land and people. Okay. That's what he's about. But the key word here that I wanted y'all to get at here is the word before. And when you look at the language in that and you go back to the original, what you get the idea of is that it's not somebody that is standing before God and doing his work. It's somebody who is standing in the face of God. He's getting up in God's face. So this is somebody who is defying God. So when it's talking about him being a mighty hunter before the Lord, you got this man who is trying to do all these acts, this conquering in the face of God, up in his face. So this is somebody who's more defined, or at least that's what it seems to me. Brad.
Tony, I read in the commentary
that
Nimrod actually was the brother.
Rebel?
Rebel.
Okay.
That's consistent.
Okay, yeah, what Brad just mentioned, for those who might not have been able to hear, some of the references that he had, it referred to Nimrod as a rebel or that along that line. So, Senator Gene.
His name means the rebel, one who revolts. So just based on that line,
okay.
That before the Lord did not mean something good.
Yeah, so... Oh, yeah, so he's a rebel, not looking to follow what God was saying. So, and that kind of leads us, you know, in this, we're not specifically told how he was a rebel, how he was in the face of God. But again, this is a question I had, and to try to get us to thinking, especially as we're going to get into the next chapter, and we're going to talk about this some more. But, you know, there's probably a lot of significant individuals that could have been brought out in this. And Nimrod's by far is given more verbiage here than anybody else. You may have mention of somebody, but it's a name. It's not telling you anything about those people for the most part until you get down to Terah and April. But Nimrod, you got a lot more here. And I just kind of asked the question. It's like, why do you think, and this is just a thought question, and I'll give you a couple of thoughts in a second, but any thought as to why Nimrod might have been singled out here? Go ahead, Trent.
There's a connection to chapter 11 where the tower of Babel will be built in the land of Shinar, association with Nimrod.
Okay. What Trent was saying is the possible connection with chapter 11 and the Tower of Babel. Dan?
Well, the cross reference verses for that, Micah 7:2, it reads, the faithful man has perished from the earth, and there is no one upright among men. They all lie in wait for blood. Every man hunts his brother with a net.
Okay.
I don't know if that means Nimrod may have been a hunter of men.
Yeah.
And he shed blood before the Lord knows it.
Yeah. And so what Danny was just mentioning is when he talked about this, he was looking at the word mighty and just some of the ramifications of that and seemed to be that I'm trying to remember everything he just said. I'm sorry. But that, you know, it's almost like they were going back to pre-Noah here where they're just seeking out that, you know, the spiritualness is gone. They're seeking after their own desires and maybe a being a shedding blood and a hunter of men type of thing here, which again, when you understand this, that's not far-fetched. It seems to be in line with that. But when you go back just for a second here, as far as why Nimrod is, I think in a couple of ways, kind of build off what Danny said just first, and then I'm going to get to what Trent said, is it seems like he is. It's almost like he's the first that desires to build a kingdom and to really establish himself in that way. And in a little bit, depending on time, may bring some things out from Josephus or something here, because you get the idea when you look at some references of this man as a tyrant, and that is what he's looking for. So you see that he is the beginning maybe of this. And there's maybe some other things along that line when we get to talking more about the Tower of Babel and some of the ramifications of there. So I'm going to hold that. And then Trent mentioned about the possible connection to the Tower of Babel as well. So,
and one of the cities he built was Nineveh, which of course was later became an enemy of Israel.
Yeah.
Could be that this is, and it's the first identifying of the peoples who would really be conquerors and consistent enemies of Israel. And also be part of the reason why he's singled out in this sort of prehistory time.
Yeah. What Bill was just bringing out too is that one of the other cities that he established was Nineveh, which of course is the capital of Assyria. For the northern kingdom, that's who ended up conquering the northern kingdom. So you see that relationship there and everything. So you can see the origins of that that's relevant to, and it's interesting, he established both Nineveh and Babylon, Babel, which became Babylon. He established both, which are the two nations that conquered the northern and southern kingdom. So you're seeing the origin of those two conquering nations. But when you focus in on Babel, I think there is a possible connection here. We're going to talk a little bit more about that when we get into the Tower of Babel. That shouldn't be lost on us that it is, that Babel was the beginning, as it says here in verse 10, that the beginning, that was part of the beginning of his kingdom. And since he, from everything that we read in here, when you're looking at the origin of the words, he appears to be somebody who's very defiant to God or God. So when we take that, I think it gives us a good segue into chapter 11 and to start the discussion and looking in more detail at the Tower of Babel. So with that, let's read the first 9 verses of chapter 11. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone and they used tar for mortar. And they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into the heavens. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Okay, so first thing we're told in verse 1 is that they're one language. They all have the same language. They're speaking the same words. They're in essence one people. They're united. He says that even God said that they are one. Verse 6, behold, they are one people. Okay, so this is what they have there. So what did this one people decide to do? They wanted to build this tower. And the way it's described here is like, let's come together, make bricks. And verse 4, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into the heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the earth. Why did the people want to build a tower, first of all? What I just read. For their own glory. Okay. Any other thoughts on that? That's certainly part of it.
Hey, the other thing, Tony, is they want to avoid. Yes, Gene, they want to avoid being scattered. God told them in Genesis 9 and verse 1 to be scattered.
Right. Yeah, it's they wanted to make a name for themselves, lest they be scattered upon the face of the earth and everything here. And so they were trying to prevent themselves from being scattered. And that's the reason why I ask the question, is this an act of pride or an act of defiance? Well, it's a little bit of both. They want to make a name for themselves, everything here. So their pride is there, but it's not, I don't think it's just pride. They want to make them a name for themselves to establish themselves, to keep them from being scattered over the face of the earth. And, you know, let's kind of hone in on that. What Gene was just talking about, you know, what had God commanded Noah and his sons to do in Genesis 9:1? Well, God blessed Noah, his sons, and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Don't fill this section of the earth. Fill the earth. Scatter among the earth. That's what he told them to do. The people, what says here is that they didn't want to scatter. They wanted to stay together. They wanted to build this city so that they could stay together, so they wouldn't be scattered over the earth. So when you see that and see that here, it seems to be saying that this is more than just an act of pride. And we got a little bit of time here. And I usually don't refer to outside things, outside writings too much. But I think in this case, you know, the writings of Josephus are not, here's my thing, are not inspired writings. They are not inspired writings. Hope that's clear. But they do give us an insight. Maybe to fill in a little bit of information. But he talks about here, I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs. Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the son, three sons of Noah, who had been born a century before the deluge, became the first to descend from the mountains to the plains, setting an example for others who stayed in the heights for fear of flood. They settled in the plain of Shinar and grew so numerous that God counseled them to send out colonies. In their disobedience, they imagined that God was trying to divide them and make them vulnerable to attack. So they followed Nimrod, the grandson of Ham, who set up a tyranny and began building a tower over which higher than any water could reach in case God ever wanted to flood the earth again. And it just goes on that they did this, and God threw them into discord by making them speak different languages so that they would not understand each other. And from then, the place became known as Babylon, because Babel means confusion. God confused their language. Again, it's not inspired writing, but what he says there seems to be consistent when you start looking at what's talked about here. The people, the reason why they were building this tower was because they wanted to stay together. God had told them to do one thing. And it appears, kind of getting back to the point that Trent had made earlier, that Nimrod, if not the ringleader, was one of the ringleaders in trying to keep them together so that he could build his kingdom there and defy God and not scatter the people over the face of the earth. Now, as we go through this, what's God's assessment of the people? Kind of laid the groundwork here. Here's what the people are wanting to do. What's God's assessment?
They're one people. They all have the same language.
They're one people. They all have the same language. What else?
Nothing will be impossible for them.
Nothing will be impossible for him. He knew he needed to do something, or else they're not going to do what I've told them to do. They're just going to stay there. They're going to build this tower, and they're going to stay put here, and they're not going to spread out. So lots of problem there. So I'd already sent out the question then when I was kind of wish I would have reworded this, but I'd already sent it out. So why did God confuse their language? What I would have said is, what did God do in response to this assessment? He confused their language, but why did he? What was the purpose in him confusing their language? Go ahead, Danny.
They had no choice but to scatter.
Yeah, he's like, okay, as long as they're one language, they're going to stay united. They're going to stay right there. So I'm going to confuse their language, which will, as a result, they will end up driving out and scattering away. Do what I told them to do. And that's the reason why I asked the first question. What was the basis of the nations? One of the key things that it said there was based on their languages, not only their families, not only their tribes, but their language. And the people who spoke the same language stuck together and they moved in different places around the earth. This is how he accomplished it. They could have done exactly what he wanted and scattered out based on just their families. And all indications are there, if they would have done that, there might have just been one language over the entire earth. But that's not the way it worked out. They didn't want to do what God said. So this is the way for him to disperse them and get to what he wanted them to do. Danny.
This makes me think of a great application for our lives today. Human beings tend to think that there are six different languages that we can use. People tend to do what happens around them. Mm-hmm. You see that by all the things going on in this place right now. People fall in with what other people do, whether it's good or bad, but especially that thing, mm-hmm. because they think somebody else is doing it, so it must be okay to do it. But for us as God people, we need to do what God says, regardless of what everybody else around us does. We need to be set apart from that to say, we know what God has told us to do in this generation. We don't care what everybody else around us does.
Yeah.
We're going to do what God told us to do.
Right. Yeah, what Danny was just talking about is he saw a good application here for us. And here you have these people who are congregating around, possibly. I want to be careful how I word this because the Bible is not explicit in saying Nimrod was the ringleader. He was the one to lead them into this. There are indications that you can draw that conclusion. But for whatever reason, whoever was leading them down this path, they were congregating around this. And so there was that safety in numbers. If we don't scatter, then we're not vulnerable to whatever dangers may be out there. We can stay together, and there's safety in us staying together. And you can see applications in that today where we will stick together and maybe get involved in things we shouldn't do because we're seeking safety in that. But we should have faith in God and just do what he's told us to do. In their case, if they were afraid of scattering because they thought they'd be more vulnerable to whatever, the dangers of the animals out there, attack, whatever the case may be, then they should have trusted God that he was going to protect them instead of trusting in themselves, type thing. Yeah, Bill.
In this example, then, followed by Abram, and the first thing we're told about Abram's faith is how he went out. That's the first command.
Great point Bill makes, as you see the contrast between these people and Abram. These people were told to go out and they stayed because they were afraid. They didn't have faith in God. Abel, on the other hand, he's down with his people and he's told to go. Not, you don't know, you know, you're going to go where I tell you. I'm not telling you where, I'm telling you to go right now. But he went. We see his faith. So we see a big contrast here. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. That's a very good point. Before we get to Abram, let's just talk a little bit here. So when we understand what's happening with these people at the Tower of Babel, are we seeing a good example of how to draw near to God here? Hopefully everybody understands the answer to that question is no. You know, when you see this, they're not seeking God. Their hearts aren't prepared for that. And, you know, there are, I'm sure, several verses we could go to. But Isaiah 29 gives us, it's one that Christ refers to a lot. And so I think it'd be good here. Verses 13 and 14. Then the Lord said, because these people draw near to me with their words and honor me with their lips, lip service, but they remove their hearts far from me, and their reverence for me consists of tradition learned by rote. Other versions say, I think, commanded or learned by men. Therefore, behold, I will once again deal marvelously with this people, wondrously and marvelously, and the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the discernment of their discerning men shall be concealed. And I think that's an important lesson for us. And we're going to refer to a couple of New Testament passages here in just a second, but to think about that. And especially if you just take that and put it in the context of what was happening then, you know, whatever men they were following, saying, I know God told you to disperse, but here's what I'm telling you, just like the devil talking to Eve. Here's what God told you, but here's what I'm telling you. You shall not surely die. God's told you to disperse. He'll be with you. He'll protect you. Now, I'm telling you, we need to stay together. Everything here. That wisdom of men, God showed them in the end that that was false, that they should have been trusting in him from the beginning. And that's going to be the case all along time here. That's what God's going to want from us. And when you look in the New Testament, you know, well, first of all, the key thing there, as was pointed out in the Isaiah passages, people were doing, in that passage, doing the right things, but their heart wasn't with him. And it all gets back to the heart. In Hebrews, the kind of the base passage that we're using for our theme for this year, Hebrews 10:22. Let us draw near with a sincere heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. And then over in James 4, verse 8, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. We need to have a pure heart in order for us to draw near to God. That's where it's going to start. Now, luckily, the chapter doesn't end with all those negative thoughts. The chapter ends with our introduction to Abram. So let's go. So here we got just a few minutes left, a couple of minutes to go. Let's go to verse 26 in chapter 11 and read to the end of the chapter. And we see that Terah lived 70 years, and he became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. From these are the records of the genealogies, generations of Terah. Terah became the father of Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Haran became the father of Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah and the land of his birth in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, and the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Ishka. Sarah was barren and had no children. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his sons, Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldees in order to enter the land of Canaan, and they went as far as Haran and settled there. The days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. One reason why I wanted to read that here as we come to a close, let me just check. Yeah, I've got 2 minutes here. Is that when you read this account, does it sound like Abram was getting the call or Terah was getting the call to leave Ur? Because it says in verse 31 that Terah took Abram and Lot and Sarah and everything. It's just an interesting thing. Not making a big deal out of it. It's just interesting here because this is where the New Testament especially gives us some more insight. In Acts 7, I'm just not going to... Here you have Stephen before the council, and he begins that defense before the council by rehashing their history. And he begins with the call of Abram from Ur. He in that verse, at least in my version, says Mesopotamia, but his call to leave his country and relatives and go to a land that God would show him. And Abraham did as he was told. Hebrews 8 talks about by faith, how Abram, when he was called, he obeyed. He did what God told him to do. And he went out not knowing where God was taking him. So, as we were talking about before, in the Tower of Babel, we have a bad example of those of how to draw near to God. But in Abram, we have a great example of how to draw near to God. Because here you have a man who was submissive and obedient to God. And it's evident that he sought God's desires and had a heart prepared to draw near to God. He did what God told him to do. He drew near to God, God drew near to him. So that's as far as we're going to go into Abram right now. Greg's going to pick up on chapter 12 on Wednesday night, and we're going to spend about the next four classes, I believe, talking a lot about Abraham there. So with that, thank you all for your comments and participation in the class.